Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 5th, 2025, and our friend David Pine is back with us. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, David. It's great to be back.
How did you find Trump's address to Congress and the way that he was trying to picture the conflict in Ukraine? Here is what a segment of what he said in that address.
States has sent hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's defense with no security, with no anything. Do you want to keep it going for another 5 years? Yeah, you would say Pocahontas says yes.
Yeah. How did you find that the only time that they clapped for Donald Trump was this particular moment that he was talking about the aid of the United States to Ukraine? What's your take? Go ahead.
I thought it was really amazing that the one thing the Democrats clapped for was to prolong the death and destruction in Ukraine, just demonstrated they've never cared about Ukrainians. They view Ukrainians as simply a pawn in, an attempt to expand America's liberal empire all the way to the Russia's western frontier. And it really, really just says a lot about how shameful and disgraceful and borderline evil that Democrats have become. Because I grew up in the 1980s. When the Democrats were a peace party, the war in Vietnam had ended, 10 years prior, and they weren't really all that supportive of wars, and frankly, neither were the Republicans at that time. But then, of course, they joined protests for the Iraq War. Many of Barack Obama and many others opposed the second Iraq War, and now they've become the party of war, the party of imperialist party, really Trump has transformed the Republican Party into a party of peace, peace and prosperity, peace and international stability. And that really was a defining moment, I think, for Trump's speech. He was very passionate. He's the one leader that has the ability and the courage to save Ukraine. And that's what I've been pushing. I've been called, a Kremlin agent. I mean, Putin, puppet, various terms like that, just for simply arguing that either the war should end along the line of control or there should be a popular referendum in the Donbas region for them to decide for themselves whether to be with Ukraine or with Russia.
Here is what J.D. Vance said yesterday in his interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News, in which he's mentioning the strategy on the part of the Trump administration when it comes to the difference between their strategy and the strategy of Joe Biden and his administration. Here is what he said.
When you would talk to the Biden administration officials in private, it's another example of a terrible situation the Biden admin left the Trump administration. When you ask them, what's the plan? Okay, we're going to spend tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in Ukraine. What is your plan? And they would honestly tell you, well, we're just going to send them weapons for as long as we can and hope eventually they can turn the tide. Hope is not a strategy. Throwing money and ammunition at a terrible conflict, that is not a strategy. The only guy in town with a strategy is the President of the United States, and everybody needs to follow his lead.
What scares me?
Yeah, here is what they're talking about. There's so much concern about the way that the Republican, the Democratic Party, and together with European countries, they were just making new strategy. I don't know that we can call it a strategy of continuing the conflict in Ukraine, but the new government, the new administration doesn't recognize that as a strategy on the part of the United States. They don't want this endless war. How do you see the way that they're trying to deal with the mainstream media, with Democratic Party on one hand? On the other hand, we have Europeans who are not agreeing with the Trump administration.
Well, first, let me say that you know, from the beginning of the war, I condemned the Biden administration as having a strategy which was morally and strategically bankrupt. What I mean by that is, the strategy essentially was to fight the Russians to the last Ukrainian in the hopes of weakening Russia militarily and economically. And then once the strategy for after the last Ukrainian soldier was killed was that the Russians would, the outcome of that, the logical outcome and inevitable outcome would be that Russian forces would sweep across all of Ukraine unopposed and occupy it and, put a pro-Russian government or leader in charge. And Vice President J.D. Vance stated, was just really a foolish and an immoral strategy. But in terms of what the Trump administration has done on Ukraine, I think it's, with the exception of this, how fast they're doing it, it's really been a masterclass in terms of showing how to end conflicts. President Trump had a transformational moment when he called President Putin for the first time in 4 years. I mean, he'd only been in office for a few weeks on February 12th. But, the Russian and the U.S. leaders met, of course, in the Rubio-Lavrov kind of summit in Riyadh and began the process of normalizing U.S.-Russia relations. And, it's not going nearly as fast as I'd like it to. We discussed my plan to end the war in essentially a few days or a week. That could have been put into place. I think the Russians would have accepted it. And we could have forced the Ukrainians to accept it by cutting off their Starlink access. But I've been really, really impressed by how President Trump has been willing to go against the Biden regime disinformation narrative that Russia was the unprovoked aggressor, we did nothing wrong, the Ukrainians did nothing wrong. The fact is, this war could have been easily prevented with a written guarantee that from the U.S. that NATO would never be expanded into Ukraine. Zelensky could have done the same thing on the eve of the war. All he had to do was say, I'm kicking NATO out of Ukraine. We'll never join Ukraine, and we're implementing the Minsk II agreement. And that would be it. Russian troops would have never entered Ukraine as long as they saw that presidential statement was being, their declaration was being implemented. There would have been peace. And the crazy thing is, 78% of the American people support Trump's drive for a negotiated peace agreement with Russia, but EU leaders are on the other side. They're doing everything they can to ensure the outbreak of World War III, the very thing that they claim they're afraid of. And there's really no need for them to expend massive sums. They don't even need to increase their defense budgets. All they need to do is establish friendly and good relations with Russia and end this war, NATO proxy war against Russia, as swiftly as possible.
Do you think that today we've learned that CIA director has confirmed that U.S. halted intelligence sharing with Ukraine? Yesterday, it was about the military aid to Ukraine that has been halted as well. How do you see the way that the Trump administration is trying to put pressure on Zelensky? And we know, I don't know, how do you find the role of Europeans in terms of, convincing Zelensky that he can fight Trump and his administration, which I don't see a viable choice for Zelensky. But how do you see the support coming to Zelensky in order to counter what is going on with the Trump administration and the way that Trump administration is trying to put pressure on Zelensky?
Well, I think Trump's doing exactly the right thing. I've been saying for the last 3 years, ever since Zelensky abandoned the signing of the Istanbul Agreement on April 9th, 2022, which would have instituted a permanent ceasefire in the war and a full Russian withdrawal to their pre-war positions, that Zelensky is the main obstacle to peace. And we saw that in his White House tantrum. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary of the United States, was interviewed on Fox News, and he stated that, Zelensky was demanding a return of all Ukraine's territory from Russia, including Crimea, $300 billion in $300 billion in Russian reparations that from their financial assets abroad, and then of course tens of thousands of if not hundreds of thousands of European peacekeepers, including U.S. peacekeepers. Trump simply wouldn't have any of it. And so Trump's doing exactly what needs to be done. I don't think he should relent. I think he should keep the military aid and intelligence support cut off from Ukraine for at least 2 months to give Russia time to prove that they're willing to end the war and achieve a ceasefire. And, we should send, ideally we would send Vice President Vance to negotiate with Russia's prime minister until a peace deal had been achieved. And again, it likely would be achieved in a week if we had, a high level negotiating team negotiating the entire time. And it could also be done with Rubio and Lavrov, of course. That'd probably be more traditional or practical. Trump's doing exactly what needs to be done to restore peace and stability to Europe and end the threat of potential Russian nuclear escalation or escalation of World War III.
Here is, David, here is what he said, Donald Trump said in his address toward regarding Europe.
Europe has sadly spent more money buying Russian oil and gas than they have spent on defending Ukraine, by far. Think of that. They've spent more buying Russian oil and gas than they have defending. And we've spent perhaps $350 billion, like taking candy from a baby. That's what happened. And they've spent $100 billion. What a difference that is. And we have an ocean separating us, and they don't. But we're getting along very well with them, and lots of good things are happening. Biden has authorized more money in this fight than Europe has spent by billions and billions of dollars. It's hard to believe that they wouldn't have stopped it and said at some point, come on, let's equalize. You got to be equal to us. But that didn't happen.
Yeah, the point he's raising in the first part of his address here in this clip, he's mentioning that Europe paid more than what it donated. I don't know that it was a loan or they have donated to Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine. It shows that how crucial, how strategic Russia is for Europe and the future of Europe. And they have no option but buying Russian gas. At the same time, you see they want to fight Russia. And he's trying to say this to Europeans. Do you think that with what has happened so far, are they going to recognize what Donald Trump is talking about?
Well, I mean, President Trump was absolutely right when he stated that Europe's, paying more to Russia to fund the war in Ukraine through these oil gas purchases than they're giving assistance to the Zelensky regime. We've certainly given over $200 billion in aid to Ukraine under the Biden administration. And President Trump views that as essentially, sunk costs. He views it as a colossal waste of money because, as he stated, this is a war that never needed to be fought in the first place. Diplomacy could have been utilized to accept the Istanbul Agreement, which was, by the way, was written by the Ukrainian delegation. The Istanbul Agreement, a lot of people don't realize, it was a counteroffer from Russia's terms to Russia, and Russia signed off on it with relatively few and minor changes, and the main point of contention was pretty much everything had been agreed to except the level of partial Ukrainian military disarmament and the size of the post-war Ukrainian army. And even those questions were within striking range, so that it would have been easily possible to end that war on April 9th as scheduled. But of course, Boris Johnson was sent by Joe Biden to pressure Zelensky not to sign the agreement. And we've had over a million casualties on the Ukrainian side since. It's 30,000 Ukrainian casualties per month that we're seeing. And that's why it's so critical that we end this war as soon as possible. But no, I don't think the Europeans are going to admit that they're helping Russia fund their war in Ukraine. That's something they try to avoid talking about.
We're talking about two different sort of view on the part of Europeans and Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is talking about, he's putting pressure on Zelensky and Ukrainians to make a deal with the United States in terms of minerals and rare earth and all of that. And we know that the rare earth minerals are mostly in the eastern part of Ukraine, which are under the control of Russians. Here comes the question. Europeans are pushing for putting troops in Ukraine on the ground in Ukraine for a security guarantee to Ukraine. Donald Trump is talking about, J.D. Vance was talking about, if we start a new business with Ukraine, with Russia, there is no need to put troops on the ground because we are doing business together. Here is the main difference between the two parties. And don't you think that the deal between Zelensky and between Ukraine and the United States and a broader picture, a bigger picture, would be Russia being part of the deal in terms of rare earth, which is a concern on the part of the Trump administration in terms of AI and semiconductors, chips, all of that, that there is a competition going on between the United States and China. How do you see the way that the Trump administration is talking about the conflict and the Europeans? And are Europeans really happy with the attitude of Donald Trump? Do they want Ukraine to make a deal in terms of minerals with the United States?
You know, this mineral deal is really been kind of hyped up. And the way it was rewritten by Zelensky, it was rewritten into a framework agreement, which is non-binding. So in other words, it doesn't, once it gets signed, and that might happen today, it's not going to bind the U.S. to do anything. It's not going to bind Ukraine to do anything. So it's really, it's essentially would be Zelensky just kind of, showing obeisance to Trump. Essentially, that's the way Trump views it, I think, is that he's asked Zelensky to come to the table to sign that in a show of deference to the U.S., as a reminder that Ukraine is essentially a U.S. military protectorate that's entirely dependent on the U.S. for its security. Europe just sees things completely differently. It's as if the Biden administration never left when it comes to the way they see things. You know, traditionally, the greater the threat from Russia, the more deferential the European leaders have been to U.S. foreign policy. You know, during times of peace, they would go in all different directions. But during times of conflict, historically, they've always deferred to U.S. foreign policy. And now they're just going off the rails. I mean, they're completely becoming anti-U.S., I would say even anti-American. And it's really putting in question from the U.S. side, what benefit that the NATO alliance membership really gives us. And I would say it doesn't give us any benefit. Really, the only alliances that have any significance are alliances between the U.S. and Britain and France, because they have nuclear arsenals. But given the fact that that they're kind of threatening World War III with Russia, that benefit gets erased and it becomes a risk, a danger to U.S. national security, because obviously if allied nuclear powers get into war with Russia, then, we could see nuclear missiles preemptively flying against the U.S. homeland. And that would be the worst case scenario. And so there's just a critical difference between how foolish and dangerous that EU leaders are behaving, and the Trump administration that's trying to not only restore peace and stability to Europe, but to actually establish a geostrategic partnership for peace with the Russian Federation that would, you know, be primarily economic related, but would also try to proactively resolve conflicts all around the world, including the Middle East, to pressure Israel and Iran to come to a modus vivendi, to help with China, because I think Trump, once he gets the strategic partnership with Russia, I think his next step is to meet with President Xi and negotiate kind of a grand bargain with China that would likely include the status of Taiwan as well. But that that can't happen soon enough. And, it just shows why Zelensky and the EU leaders cannot be trusted to be involved in negotiations, because, despite what Zelensky offered with this, partial ceasefire that wouldn't apply to ground combat, only apply to missiles and naval warfare. He has zero interest in peace. This is all a scam from his point. And I'm grateful to hear that Trump is not taking the bait, and that he's continuing to shut off U.S. intelligence assistance and non-military assistance to Ukraine as well.
David, when it comes to Zelensky, don't you think that even having Zelensky signing an agreement would not be that much important, because we know that he's in office, he's not the official president of Ukraine? There has to be some sort of presidential election in Ukraine. We don't know if the Ukrainian people would support him to sign any sort of deal. Or how do you see the way Donald Trump started talking about this when Zelensky rejected to sign a deal, and he said if he doesn't want to sign it, and his days are numbered in terms of being the president of Ukraine. But what does it mean for Donald Trump and his administration? Do they really want to replace a new presidential election in Ukraine? Why did they not try to force that on Europeans and Ukraine together?
Well, I think that both the U.S. under the Trump administration and Russian leaders are united in demanding new democratic elections in Ukraine. And polls show that Zelensky has about 11%. He'll claim 63%, but in fact, the polls show about 11%. So unless he were to ban his main presidential challengers from running, his electoral defeat would be guaranteed. And even General Kellogg, who's an ardent Ukraine supporter, has said that Ukraine must hold elections by, I think, late summer or early fall at the latest. So September, October at the latest, essentially. And, that's really the key is restoring democracy to Ukraine. Biden, talked about this war between democracy and autocracy and continually lied about the situation in Ukraine, because as you and I think have talked about previously, Zelensky is ruled as a totalitarian dictator. I recently published an article in which, I quoted a senior ranking former Ukrainian official who described a situation in Ukraine where Zelensky was just really ruling with an iron fist, and that even opposition, even members of parliament from his own party have been thrown in prison as political prisoners for daring to oppose his mad drive to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian, rather than save Ukraine with a just and lasting peace that would ensure the independence and security of Ukraine within 87% of its pre-war controlled territory, as I've been advocating, and as Trump's trying to achieve as well. So there's you know, with regards to the mineral deal with Russia that you stated before, you know, Trump has much more, and the U.S. has much more to gain through a mineral deal with the Russian Federation than with Ukraine, because even if this agreement actually had some binding mechanism to pay back the U.S. through mineral rare earth mineral profits or simply the rare earth minerals alone, it would take many years to develop those, because Ukraine has been wrecked as a country, and even the rare earth minerals, mineral mines that are not out of not in Russian control or have been annexed by Russia are really largely undeveloped. And so this would be very speculative. It would have to be, it could be over a decade before we even saw those a lot of rare earth minerals from Ukraine. And it just makes so much sense to do this with Russia instead. And of course, we've heard that the UK already did a mineral deal with Ukraine. So in effect, they're claiming with their 100 year security alliance that they got the mineral rights before we did. So it's kind of a scam in that regards as well.
David, there has been two sort of talks between the United States and Russia so far, one in Saudi Arabia, the other one in Istanbul. Istanbul took 6.5 hours and to talk about the bigger, it seems to me that it wasn't all about Ukraine, it was about the bigger picture that they're trying to draw for their relationship. How do you see, what is the bigger picture in the eyes of the Trump administration, in your opinion? You mentioned that it's not all about Ukraine, is in the Middle East as well. We know that is Far East, is in Taiwan as well. How do you see the way that Donald Trump sees these sort of conflicts that the United States is currently facing?
Well, I think President Trump is really demonstrating an ability to think strategically, much like Richard Nixon. And, I believe, I can't confirm, but I think he was briefed on Vivek Ramaswamy and my plan to kind of reorder the international order to replace the current bipolar international order in which Russia and China are on one pole and the U.S. is on the other with its Western allies, with the tripolar international order, one in which none of the nuclear superpowers are allied. And that would be a much more favorable international order for the United States. And, I also was successful in getting my Russia-Ukraine peace plan to a top, a member of Trump's cabinet on the national security side. And so he very, very possibly could have seen that as well. But irregardless, he is implementing a lot of my suggestions, and it appears that he is trying to do what is being called kind of a reverse Nixon, which is to rather than try to establish an entente with China against Russia, the Soviet Union, as Nixon did at the time. He's trying to establish kind of entente, not really an entente, but I would say, again, a geostrategic partnership with the Russian Federation that is not aimed at China militarily, but is designed to neutralize its military alliance with China. So it wouldn't be a threat to China, but it would weaken its alliance system. And that would be not only its military alliance system, but also its economic, in terms of BRICS. I think what Trump envisions is to try to wean Russia and India out of the BRICS system, either just to do that, or maybe even to get them to join a Western-led trade bloc that would counter China. China obviously is an economic superpower and powerhouse that greatly is increasingly overmatching the United States, and especially an industrial power where China likely has about 3.8 times larger industrial base than the United States. And we just can't even imagine that level of industrial might, but that's really what we're facing right now. And Trump, of course, is trying to reindustrialize the U.S. and especially our defense industrial base. But that's the thinking, I think, that Trump is trying to do. And you mentioned that, those talks have gone, combined, those talks have been 10 hours long. So what we've heard is that, you know, negotiations are proceeding at a snail's pace. And Trump has stated that they're much more advanced. You know, he thinks that a peace deal could be hammered out with Russia, you know, this month. And, you know, there must be other talks going on that we're just not aware of. It could be, you know, at the embassy level. It could be, you know, remote via Zoom. But, you know, they need to speed up a lot more, you know, because we really need a peace agreement in place by the end of the month, because China is already demonstrating that it's, you know, it's already threatening war in or a blockade of Taiwan in April. They just announced a 7.2% increase in their defense budget during Trump's address. And also during Trump's presidential address, the Chinese embassy in the U.S. Said that if war is what Trump wants, then war is what he'll get. So, you know, China's being very combative. I'm not really sure why. I guess it's in response to the 20% tariff, which is, I would argue, quite moderate.
David, when you look at the United Kingdom, Starmer, and the way that they're behaving right now, do you think that, do they really want to be part of the deal between the United States and Russia? What is the main goal on the part of the British government?
The main goal of the British government and many EU leaders as well, such as Macron, is to keep the war going indefinitely. They don't want peace. The terms that they essentially threw out for a ceasefire were almost identical to what Zelensky wanted, including, you know, a full Russian military withdrawal from all of the, you know, formerly Ukrainian territories that comprise 19% of Ukraine's internationally recognized territory. And that, and not only that, they also are insisting on, you know, tens of thousands of Ukrainian peacekeepers, or rather European peacekeepers, if not hundreds of thousands, deployed to Ukraine to the front line. And those two things are so unacceptable to Russia that they could very well get us into a nuclear war with the Russian Federation. So, yeah, they couldn't be more oppositional, you know, to what Trump is trying to accomplish. They're completely on Zelensky's side. They're going off the rails, and they're opposing the U.S. across the board in foreign policy.
You see that. Is there any sort of connection between the establishment in the United States and European leaders right now that they're trying to say it's Donald Trump? Let's just pass. He did it. It's for 4 years. Let's just think of that. And do you think that they're trying to convince Europeans that in the aftermath of the Trump administration, there would be a new administration in the United States which would change everything? That's why they don't need to get along. They don't need to support Donald Trump in his sort of ideas in terms of dealing with Russia or even China.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the deep state, you know, centered on the Democrat Party was responsible for trying to coordinate with EU leaders to get Zelensky to be defiant and so resistant to peace in his talks with President Trump and to refuse to sign the minerals deal in the fiasco from the Ukrainian side that we witnessed on Friday. So that is definitely going on. We know that. And it's very unproductive. You know, it's essentially fractured the U.S.-Ukraine alliance. You know, we don't really have an alliance anymore. And what's so great is Trump has stated that, you know, he doesn't want Ukraine to win. He doesn't want Russia to win. He doesn't stand with either country. He wants the U.S. to be an honest broker, an honest mediator, to ensure the best deal, you know, long term for both sides. You know, both sides are going to have to make concessions. He's not going to support either side. He stands with peace, and that's the way it's going to be. And he has the ability to force Zelensky to sign any agreement that he negotiates with Putin. And I think that's a really good thing. But yeah, there's absolutely coordination between EU leaders and Democrat leaders. But 4 years is a long time. You know, if that's really what Democrats are trying to sell to the EU leaders, that, hey, 4 years from now, this is, we can all throw this out the window and return to our policy of, neo-imperial, global Western hegemony, and imperialist war, proxy wars with Russia. I think that's very foolish, and that's going to get Europe into a lot of trouble and pose a huge threat to them.
In terms of tariffs, David, do you think that it's a sort of negotiation process for Donald Trump, and he wants to negotiate with Canada, Mexico, and even China and find some sort of solution that he is seeking for through imposing tariffs on these countries? Are they going to work, in your opinion?
Well, I don't really understand the rationale for the across-the-board 25% tariff on Canada. Mexico makes more sense, but they seem to be cooperating quite well with the U.S. So I think even those tariffs were unnecessary. So I think the tariffs on China should be much higher. But I was really excited to, I've always been a big supporter of tariffs. So, since 92. I think that plan to, issue an executive order to institute reciprocal tariffs on April 2nd is really good. I mean, certainly there's going to be a lot of blowback from China because they have really high tariffs on U.S. goods. But essentially it gives other countries the ability to lessen our tariffs, because if they lessen their tariffs, our tariffs automatically go down as well. And it really puts the ball in their court to establish, bilateral free trade. So there's, it's really hard for another country to complain, U.S. tariffs being the same as theirs when they have the ability to reduce them. So there is going to be quite a shock to the U.S. economy and a lot of, push pressure for Trump to relent. But this is the way to make the U.S. wealthy again. It's the way to restore and defense an industrial base. And, Trump should make clear that he wants war with no one. He doesn't want war with China either. He's willing to compromise with China on Taiwan. Hopefully he'll implement, my EU style confederation plan between the U.S., between China and Taiwan, that would entirely resolve the Taiwan crisis, which I continue to view as the greatest threat to humanity right now. Especially now that he's working so well with Russia to try to resolve the war in Ukraine. But I think these temporary tariffs, I think, are not really that justifiable. But I think his reciprocal tariff plan makes a lot more sense.
Before wrapping up, in your opinion, how a Ukrainian settlement would influence the situation in the Middle East? You mentioned that the way that Russia and the United States can cooperate. But could you give us a picture that you're thinking that would be the outcome of this sort of Ukrainian settlement?
Well, it's a little bit unclear because, Trump has kind of been all over the place with the Middle East. He's reinstituting maximum pressure campaign on Iran, which I totally support. I think that's a good idea. I think we need to really get pressure Israel to end its war in Gaza. I think the ceasefire agreement that was signed was really good. Israel, of course, as I predicted, is trying to break the ceasefire. They've reinstituted their illegal, kind of starvation blockade against Gazans, kind of reinstituting the killing there. And that's really lamentable. We need to pressure them to stop that and restore humanitarian assistance. There remains the threat of regional war between Israel and Iran, so long as the Gaza issue is not resolved. And Trump is, he's made some really crazy, surprising proclamations. He's talked about, a new nuclear agreement with Iran. I'm very skeptical of that. I don't think that's really in our interest. I think Iran is already a nuclear power. There's not really much we can do about that. If we could get them to freeze their nuclear arsenal, I think that would be a good idea. That would be something that we could support if it was, we verified it. But with, you know, regards to Russia and China, he's talked about 40% cuts to our defense spending. And the only way he can achieve that is if he not only makes peace with Russia and Ukraine and has some kind of mutualist security agreement with them, welcoming them to one extent or another into the security architecture of Europe, but also if he resolves the Taiwan issue, minimally would include, a confederation agreement between China and Taiwan and a full cutoff of all U.S. military assistance to Taiwan, and accepting that Taiwan will be permanently part of the Chinese sphere of influence. So, I think he really needs to abandon his plan to, deport all of the Palestinians out of Gaza. I think that's his worst plan that he has. Kind of move forward along the ceasefire agreement plan, which is has three phases. The second phase, which was supposed to begin on February 16th, and it was supposed to be negotiating a final peace agreement between Hamas and Israel that would include Hamas, leaving political power in return for a full Israeli military withdrawal. And, I think that could be best achieved again with Russian participation.
Thank you so much, David, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks, Nima. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Yeah. Take care.